Thanks, Brooke. My name is Carrie. I'm a recovered alcoholic. My home group is the New Horizons group, and I'm currently living in the disciplines of steps 10, 11, and 12. All right, so this is a big chapter, right? I think one of the biggest, if not the biggest, and we're not even halfway through. So I'm going to just get into it. There's a lot of reading, but a lot of notes and a lot of highlights. So you guys get ready. All right, so I'm going to open. We're on page 96. I'm going to open with my joke. Feel free to use it in any big book workshop or in any big book meeting that you attend. It makes big book studies a little bit more fun. So the joke is that the dyslexic codependent sponsee, alcoholic sponsee, called her sponsor because she had gotten this big fight with her boyfriend, and her boyfriend can't get sober, and he got drunk again, and blah, 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 right? And so her sponsor says, well, I'm not a marriage counselor. I'm not a relationship counselor. You want to go to page 69. That's where relationships and the sex is in the big book. And she's dyslexic, so she turns to page 96, and she reads, do not be discouraged if your prospect does not respond at once. Search out another alcoholic and try again. You are sure you'll find someone desperate enough to accept with eagerness what you offer. Ba-dump bump. And then it goes on. So I'm just going to give that to you guys. You can have some fun with it in your big book studies. Big book studies, when you first get into them, before you become a complete geek like us, they can be hard to sit through. So a little bit of comedy, a little bit of humor, it makes all the difference for new people who are just trying to absorb this book. So, but back to what this is actually talking about, and we are in step 12. So this is talking about the prospect as an alcoholic you're trying to help, right? A prospective member of Alcoholics Anonymous or a prospective person you might want to sponsor. So this is some really sound advice. So I'm actually going to read this whole page because there's really nothing that I can skip. Do not be discouraged if your prospect or new person does not respond at once. Search out another alcoholic and try again. You are sure to find someone desperate enough to accept with eagerness what you offer. We find it a waste of time to keep chasing a man who cannot or will not work with you, right? And we talked last week a little bit about the person who says, oh yes, I'm willing to go to any lengths for victory over alcohol. I'll do whatever it takes. I'll stand in my head on my head in the corner. I'll push a quarter across the street with, you know, in traffic with my nose, all that stuff. And then you say, okay, and you open the book and it's like, what do you mean a book? What do you mean steps? You know? And so that's what we're talking about here. If you can't, you can bring the horse to water, but you can't make him drink, right? And so sometimes, as this chapter's already told us, they might have to go out and do some more drinking, right? To get that gift of desperation. And it is a gift. If it propels you into doing this stuff, it's a gift. So don't try to rob somebody of that gift, right? Don't try to take away someone's alcoholic bottom, because all it does is it prolongs it. So they're going to have an alcoholic bottom. Is it going to be now, or are you going to help them to prolong it for a year, maybe two? And that's a question that I have to ask my higher power every time I'm working with someone. So if you leave such a person alone, he may soon become convinced that he cannot recover by himself. Right. So if I'm not dragging the drunk off the bar stool and tying him up and, you know, handcuffing him to a chair so he doesn't drink, then he might actually get to a bottom where he wants to stop and is willing to go to any lengths. To spend too much time on any one situation is to deny another alcoholic of an opportunity to live and be happy. One of our fellowship failed entirely with his first half dozen prospects. That's Bill. He often says that if he had continued to work on them, he might have deprived many others who have since recovered of their chance. Suppose now you're making your second visit to a man. He has read this volume and he says he's prepared to go through with the 12 steps of the program of recovery. Having had the experience yourself, you can give him much practical advice. So having had the experience yourself, you can give him much practical advice. I try to make it a rule of thumb that I don't give advice on things that I don't have experience with, right? So that's one of the things that my sponsor, when we first sat down, She explained to me very clearly. At the time, I had a four-year-old, or maybe she was five by then. But anyway, my sponsor says, you know, you have Taylor. I don't have any kids. I never have. And there's going to come a point in time where you're going to have some issues, you know, teenage issues, custody issues. I don't know, but they're going to come because it's life. And I'm not going to pretend that I know how to help you through those things sober, because I haven't been through them. I don't have kids, but I do sponsor a lot of women. I've heard a lot of fifth steps, and I can give you a number of someone who can help you through that, of someone who has been through that. And so that's what I pass on. I don't give advice, but I give a phone number, and I don't share your experience with the other person, but I do call them and I say, hey, listen, so-and-so might end up giving you a call about, some experience you can share, you know, and then I leave it at that. Because I'm not God, nor do I want to pretend to be. Let him know that you're available if he wishes to make a decision and tell his story, but do not insist upon it if he prefers to consult someone else. God, it feels like we've been through this. Am I repeating something that I did last week? No. Okay. So I guess it's because I went over my sponsorship requirements. So one of the things that I do on my sponsorship agreement, requirements, guidelines, whatever you want to call it, is I put other phone numbers on there on the bottom, right? So the first section is what I don't do as a sponsor. The second section is what I do as a sponsor. The third section is what I will expect of you if you're going to call me your sponsor. And the third and the fourth section is three additional phone numbers of people who I think might be able to help you if you don't like what I have to offer, if you don't like what I have to say. And so those three people, I encourage you to reach out to them and have conversations before making a decision that you want to work with me. And I do that right from the get. He may be broke or homeless. If he is, you might want to, let's skip this part because we got so much more to go. So this is a really good, on page 98, it's not the matter of, so what the part is that we skipped, just to condense it down, is it's saying if he may be broke or homeless, you might want to help him out a little bit, right? But we want to make sure that we don't deprive our family. We want to make sure that we don't put ourselves in a dangerous situation. We want to make sure, you know, there's some ifs, right? And then the book warns us, but don't help him too much because you could be hindering him, right? Don't help him too much, because he could come to rely upon you instead of upon God. So that's where we are right now. And remember, when we first started reading this chapter, I said one of the reasons it's so big is because it's not going to give you clear-cut instructions, right? It's going to tell you to go to God. It's going to tell you, hey, if your prospect does this, you might want to try this. If your prospect does that, you might want to try that. And that's where we are right now. It just went through, you know, you might want to give him some financial assistance, but other times you might not want to give them anything. And then the next paragraph on 98, it's kind of tying the two together, telling you discernment, discretion, discernment, discretion, by saying it's not the matter of giving that is the question, but when and how to give, right? Discernment and discretion. That often makes the difference between failure and success. The minute we put our work on a service plan, the alcoholic commences to rely upon us and our assistance rather than upon God. He clamors for this or that, claiming he cannot master alcohol until some material needs are cared for. Nonsense. Some of us have taken a very hard. I put an explanation point. I think that was me. It doesn't look like it's written in the book. Maybe that wasn't supposed to be an explanation point. I think I wrote an explanation point, so forgive me for saying it like that. That's a note I put in there myself. Some of us have taken very hard knocks to learn the truth. Job or no job, wife or no job, wife or no wife, we simply do not stop drinking so long as we place dependence upon other people ahead of dependence upon God. Burn into the consciousness of every man that he can get well regardless of anyone. The only condition is that he trusts God and clean house. I'm going to go to page 99 And it's going to reiterate this. So the very bottom of page 99, it says, let no alcoholic, so it's reiterating it again, let no alcoholic say that he cannot recover unless he has his family back. That just isn't so. In some cases, the wife will never come back for one reason or another. Remind the prospect that his recovery does not depend upon other people. I mean, it really drives this point home. It is dependent upon his relationship with God. And that is why, and why it's kind of reiterating and reiterating this is because you, have you guys heard the phrase in meetings, grow or go, right? That's one of the things that I don't hear it too much anymore, but that's one of the ones that it's not a pet peeve of mine. I believe that we have to grow along spiritual lines or we're walking in the other direction, you know, out the door or toward the door. So that's what this is about. It's just simply saying, I need to continue, right? Continue practice and, continue, improve and practice, continue, improve and practice, wash, rinse and repeat steps 10, 11 and 12. So, both you and the new man must walk day by day in the path of spiritual progress. And I think it's really cool that every time in this book uses the word progress, not perfection, it always puts the word spiritual before it, right? Spiritual progress, not spiritual perfection. On page 59, 60, where it's, we come to the end of the steps and it says, that we claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection is because these are the things that we're never going to get a graduation certificate on. Right. And thank goodness, because there's always room to grow, at least for me. If you persist, remarkable things will happen. When we look back, we realize that the things which came to us when we put ourselves in God's hands were better than anything we could have planned. Follow the dictates of a higher power and you will presently live in a new and wonderful world, no matter what your present circumstances. This is a highlight of mine from follow to circumstances. And what it reminds me of is that it's saying, so God will enable me to match calamity with serenity, so long as I do as I think he would have me do. So long as I be who I think he would have me be. So if I follow the dictates, then I can live in a wonderful world, happy, joyous, and free, regardless of my circumstances. Regardless if I lose a loved one. Regardless if I lose my life savings. Regardless if I mean, you name it, right? Lose your job, lose your house, and I get to live in a wonderful world, happy, joyous, and free, if I'm following the dictates of a higher power. And that's a promise. That's one of the 12-step promises. So on page 101, oh, this is my favorite. Okay, so I'm going to actually go back down to the bottom of page 100 first. So bottom of page 100. Assuming we're spiritually fit, and that's a highlight of mine today. It wasn't always. I missed that for a long time. We can do all sorts of things alcoholics are not supposed to do. Now, this is the part I had highlighted, underlined, and circled in my first big book. And I read this to my first sponsor with the arrogance of, I mean, I can't even tell you. And I read this to her after she caught me doing some things that I shouldn't have been doing with people I shouldn't have been with in a place that I shouldn't have been at. Right. And so I opened the book and I'm going to read this to her. Right. And this is the part that I had underlined, circled and highlighted, assuming we're spiritually fit, which I did not have highlighted. We can do all sorts of things that people aren't supposed to do. People have said that we must not go where liquor is served. We must not have it in our homes. We must shun friends who drink. We must avoid moving pictures which show drinking scenes. We must not go into bars. Our friends must hide their bottles if we go into their houses. We mustn't think or be reminded about alcohol at all. our experience shows that this is not necessarily so. Right? And then it goes on to say we meet these conditions every day. And here's the problem, though. Here's the problem. When I read this page to my sponsor, and I have all the highlights, you know, that are like any scheme of combating alcoholism, which proposes to shield a man from temptation is doomed to failure. Even a woman who sends her husband off to the Greenland ice caps, a Eskimo could show up and ruin everything. Like, I'm not supposed to hide from alcohol, right? And my sponsor lovingly reminded me that this is page 101 in the chapter Working with Others, which is the step 12. And I'm on page 24 on step one. And that there's a big difference between step one, where it says on page 24, I'll just turn to page 24, that for the fact is, for reasons yet obscure, I have lost the power of choice in drink, right? Like, I don't have any willpower that can control my desire for drinking. I can't even think the drink through because the suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago, I just don't recall. I'm without defense against the first drink. And there's a complete failure of the kind of defense which keeps one from putting his hand on a hot stove. I get burned and I just keep doing it over and over again. That's what happens. And that's where my mind is. My alcoholic mind is, I have no mental defense when I'm on page 24 on step one. But after having had a spiritual awakening as the result of the steps, by the time I get to the step 10th step promises, instead of continuing to put my hand on that hot stove, now I'm at a place where the problem has been removed and I recoil as if from a hot flame. And when I go to put my hand on a hot stove, I just recoil. I don't touch the hot stove anymore. And that is why this page reads like this. It's not for newcomers. It's not for the still suffering, unrecovered alcoholic. This is assuming we're spiritually fit and having had a spiritual awakening, right? And so let me read this part again. Our experience shows that that is not necessarily so. We don't need to shun friends who drink. We don't need to avoid moving pictures. Like, we can go to a movie and see in the theater a movie where people are drinking. It's not a big deal. Our experience shows that that is not necessarily so. We don't have to hide away and stay away from slippery people, places, and things. We meet these conditions every day. An alcoholic who cannot meet them still has an alcoholic mind. And when I was doing these things in my first 3 months of sobriety, unrecovered, I had very much an alcoholic mind. I have an alcoholic body forever, but today I don't have an alcoholic mind. I've been restored to sanity. I can do these things and go to these places because I don't have the problem has been removed. I no longer have an alcoholic mind. But that takes some work, right? It takes a spiritual experience. And I'll read this part only because it's funny. His only chance for sobriety might be someplace like a Greenland ice cap. And even there, an Eskimo might turn up with a bottle of scotch and ruin everything. Ask any woman who has sent her husband to distant places on the theory that he would escape the alcohol problem. In our belief, any scheme of combating alcoholism, which proposes to shield the man from temptation, is doomed to failure. That is a highlight. I don't care what your triggers are. Once you're a recovered alcoholic, there's no such thing. I mean, to be quite honest, Tuesday was my trigger, you know? I mean, breathing was my trigger. And this is said throughout the book. Let's turn to page 120 real quick, and I'll just give a little... on page 120, it says, we never, never, it says the word never twice on purpose. We never, never try to arrange a man's life as to shield him from temptation. Again, we don't stay away from slippery people, places, and things. That's rehab bullshit. That's not AA. page 147, it says, page 147 says, now you are trying to run, okay, this is for the employer, and it's telling the employer that not to shield him from temptation to drink. It says he will be appreciate knowing that you are not bothering your head about him, that you are not suspicious, nor are you trying to run his life so he will be shielded from temptation to drink. If he is conscientiously following the program of recovery, he can go anywhere your business may call him as a recovered alcoholic. That's on page 147. So our rule is not to avoid a place where there's drinking if we have a legitimate reason for being there. That includes bars, nightclubs, dances, wedding receptions, plain old ordinary whoopee parties, which I don't really know what that is, but it sounds fun. To a person who has experienced, to a person who has had experience with an alcoholic, this may seem like tempting providence, but it isn't. It isn't. Now, you will note that we made an important qualification, right? And they're talking about if we have a legitimate reason to be there, if we are spiritually fit. This is talking about the recovered alcoholic, not the still suffering recovering alcoholic. So have I got a good social or personal reason for going to this place, or am I expecting to steal a little vicarious pleasure to the atmosphere, from the atmosphere of such places? Now, I know that when I was new and crying when I got in trouble, I got my feelings hurt. You know, my sponsor hurt my feelings when she told me, because then she came up with a rule. And I didn't like rules. And she told me after the night that I got caught in the strip club, she told me that I was no longer to go anywhere until I recovered, that my daughter couldn't go. So if there was a concert that didn't allow minors, doesn't allow me. If there was a restaurant that all of a sudden, and it really upset me because there was this meeting that I would go to every Saturday night at 8 o'clock to 9:15. It's called ABC. It was an hour and 15 minute long meeting. And everybody, like all the people my age and like everybody from that meeting, would go out to the McMiniman's restaurant/bar after the meeting. But after 10 o'clock, there's no minors permitted in there. And so it was really embarrassing when 10 o'clock would come after only being there for 45 minutes and I would have to leave and everybody else could stay and have fun. But, you know, that's what I needed at the time. I think that it was a good rule of thumb for this alcoholic. I don't need that anymore. And I was crying to her because, you know, I had to leave. And so I called her at 10 o'clock on my way home one night from McMiniman's, to probably make her feel guilty or whatever. And I remember I was sobbing and, I was just saying, well, I just don't understand. When can I have my life back? And when can I go to these places? And when can I hang out with my friends? It's bad enough that I have to hang out with the stupid AA people already. And when can I, you know, and all this stuff. And she just said, and it didn't make sense at the time. And it totally does today. As soon as you don't want to anymore, then you can. And today I get it because I can go to anywhere I want. I could go to that strip club. I have no desire to, you know, I have zero desire to go hang out in bars today. And the ironic part is I can, and safely, if I had a legitimate reason for being there. So why sit with long, this is on page 102, why sit with a long face in places where there's drinking, sighing about the good old days? If it's a happy occasion, try to increase the pleasure of those there. A business occasion, go and attend to your business enthusiastically. If you are with a person who wants to eat at a bar, by all means, go. Now, again, this is talking to the person who's been through pages 1 through 102, right? This isn't talking about the person 1 week sober. Let your friends know they are not to change their habits on your account. I love this line so much. I find so much humor in this. Think about what this is saying. At a proper time and place, explain to all your friends why alcohol disagrees with you. If you do this thoroughly, few people will ask you to drink. Nobody wants to watch me drink after I tell them how I drink or what happens to me when I drink. While you were drinking, you were withdrawing from life little by little. Now you're getting back into the social life of this world. Don't start to withdraw again just because your friends drink liquor. Your job now is to be at the place where you can be of maximum helpfulness to others. So never hesitate to go anywhere if you can be helpful. Here's a highlight. You should not hesitate to visit the most sordid spot on earth on such an errand. Keep on the firing line of life with these motives and God will keep you unharmed. And it's just so funny. And there's a note here for page 147. 147 is just a reconciliation with. Well, I'm going to skip that for now. The important part that I want to point out here is that for me, and I don't know if this is the same for you, but the most sordid spot on earth has changed for me throughout the years, right? So at one point in my sobriety, I think the most sordid spot on earth that would really test my sobriety, would really test my fit spiritual condition, would be a bar, right? Because I had no mental defense against alcohol for a long time. And if I was around people drinking, like that would be the most difficult place for me to go to. And then, you know, I recovered, the problem was removed. I was still kind of sick in other areas because we only recover from alcoholism and not humanism. And the most sordid spot on earth would probably be my mother-in-law's house. Right? Like, I mean, I'm just saying, I'll just leave it at that because it with respect to her, but that was the most sordid spot on earth for a little while. Today, the only thing that really tests my fit spiritual condition is a bad AA meeting. Today, the most sordid spot on earth for this alcoholic is to go somewhere that is using the AA name, but not the AA message. And I understand that that's on me, not on them, right? And every group has the right to be wrong. But as my sponsor put it, because I tried to go to a group to help them for a long time, right? A couple of years. And I just kept on regretting it, right? And my sponsor said, listen, don't get in the pig pen and expect not to get dirty, right? They don't need your help. And then somebody else said something about casting pearls before swine or something like that. I think it's a Bible reference, but I think I know what it means. I haven't looked it up. And it made sense also to where, you know, if somebody doesn't want what I have to offer, then kind of like what this chapter says, then don't go there trying to offer it. And so this meeting that I was trying to, you know, help for a couple of years, I had let go. Absolutely. I had gone back to my old home group by now. I was with New Horizons again, and a couple of years had passed and they asked me to speak. And I instantly said, no, you know, and I called my sponsor and I'm like, can you believe the such and such group wants me to go in there? And my sponsor said, oh, well, you said yes. Right. And I said, well, no, I mean, I'm not going to get in the, you know, don't get in the pig pen with if you don't expect it, if you don't want to get dirty, right? And she's like, yeah, but the big book also says that when invited, right, if you have a legitimate reason for being there, if you're not just going there to help, then you should be able to go to even the most sordid spot on earth on such an errand. And so I had to call that lady back and tell her yes. And I did. And I prayed beforehand in the parking lot. And I carried a message, and it didn't even need to be a message about service or the traditions. It was just a message about sobriety. And I succeeded, and I left unharmed. God kept me unharmed. And so I think the most sordid spot on earth sometimes can differ depending on where we are in our sobriety. Many of us keep liquor in our homes. We often need it to carry green recruits through a severe hangover. Some of us still serve it to our friends, provided they are not alcoholic. Now, this I would just preference with every household is different, and what works for one isn't going to work for the other, and there's no right or wrong, right? For example, I live in a dry house. I don't have alcohol in my house at all. Nobody here drinks. Even when my dad's in town, my house doesn't have alcohol. I'm looking around the room right now. I have a couple of sponsees in the room who, you know, their husbands drink, and it's perfectly fine. And they can go to the store and buy beer for their husband. It's on the grocery. It's on the list. And that's perfectly fine. So what's right for one household and what's right for another household is up to the household. It's up to the group conscience of the household. And every situation is going to be different. So, but some of us think we should not serve liquor to anyone. We never argue these questions. We feel that each family, in the light of their own circumstances, right, ought to decide for themselves. Again, group conscience. So, this next paragraph on page 103, this is tradition 10. So you know how in the long form of tradition 10, it talks about that we should never express any opinion on outside controversial issues. And then it names three in particular. It names religion, politics, and alcohol reform. So we know what sectarian religion is. We know what politics are. But sometimes I find myself itching my head, like, alcohol reform. Why would that even come up in a meeting? I've heard it come up in a meeting. I just didn't know what it was. So I've been in meetings before where someone will start to go on a rant about, I can't believe alcohol is still legal. Do you know how many people die from alcohol-related incidences? I mean, I can't believe that there's a brewery on every street corner in this town. What are they trying to do? Kill people? Alcohol should be outlawed. There's liver disease. There's so much more out there other than alcoholism. Why is it? No, the thing is, AA has no opinion on even alcohol. We're not out to try to save the world. 90%, the truth is, 90% of this world can drink with impunity. It's only 10% of us that are like me, and I don't get quenched, I get more thirsty. And one thing leads to another, and I don't stop until I run out, blackout, or pass out. But 90% of the world, that doesn't happen to. So I'm going to read this paragraph. It says, we are careful never to show intolerance or hatred of drinking as an institution. Experience shows that such an attitude is not helpful to anyone. Every new alcoholic looks for this spirit among us and is immensely relieved when he finds that we are not witch burners. A spirit of intolerance might repel alcoholics whose lives could have been saved had it not been for such stupidity. Strong language. We would not even do the cause of temperance drinking any good, for not one drinker in 1,000 likes to be told anything about alcohol by one who hates it. So what does a normal drinker look like? I'm going to flip to page, looking for it. Vision for You. It's the first page of Vision for You. Oh, here we go. It's page 151, of course. So this is what page 151. This is what a normal person, this is what alcohol does for a normal person who's not alcoholic. For most normal folk, drinking means conviviality, companionship, and colorful imagination. It means release from care, boredom, and worry. It means joyous intimacy with friends and a feeling that life is good. Now, why would I want to take that away from 90% of the rest of the world? I wouldn't. And the reason why is because I happen to love peanut butter and jelly sandwiches. I am not allergic to peanuts. And if those people with peanut allergies wanted to take that away from me, I would be very upset. So I'm not going to take away their alcohol as long as I can say it, keep my peanut butter and jelly sandwiches. So on page 103, back to that page, someday we hope that Alcoholics Anonymous will help the public to a better realization of the gravity of the alcoholic problem. But we shall be of little use if our attitude is one of bitterness or hostility. Drinkers will not stand for it. After all, our problems were of our own making. Bottles were only a symptom. Symbol, sorry. Besides, we have stopped fighting anybody or anything. We have to. So the next chapter is Two Wives. Couple things about Two Wives. I'm not going to go over everything in Two Wives. I'm going to combine Two Wives and family afterward, in next week. So hopefully next week we'll get through both of them. But, one of the things that I want to point out in Two Wives is it starts with, in this on page 104, it starts with the title with an asterisk. So normally we see these little asterisks throughout and we read the asterisks, but this one has an asterisk on the actual title. So that's pretty important. So I'm going to read the asterisk to the title first. It says, written in 1939, when there were few women in AA, this chapter assumes that the alcoholic in the home is likely to be the husband, because at that time it was, that's who the alcoholic was. It's not being, and I just want to make clear, because when I first read this chapter, I was under the impression that it was very, I don't want to get political here, but, I was very offended. It was sexist to me. And I'll stop there, but I called it some pretty extreme names. But what I have to understand is when this was written, it wasn't written to wives to be sexist. It was written because most of the alcoholics in the household back then that were in AA were men. It was written factual for the time. It has nothing to do with who should be an alcoholic and who shouldn't, who should be the head of the household and who shouldn't. It's just a fact. It's a fact of when it was written, and that's it. So I'm glad that we have this asterisk to start us out, right? It says, but many of the suggestions given here may be adapted to help the person who lives with a woman alcoholic. So it's saying just twist it around, you know, just play with the words. It's not a big deal. Whether she is still drinking or is recovering in AA. This is one of the only places that it says recovering in the book too, is in this little asterisk, in this little side note. There's two places in the book that says recovering. This is one of them. And the other one is in the next chapter, or maybe it's in this chapter, talking about the husband who is newly sober and still recovering from alcoholism. So with that said, as far as Two Wives go, let's try to take it with a grain of salt. And like my sponsor told me, these last four chapters, particularly after working with others. So steps 1 through 12 are from the doctor's opinion, depending on who your sponsor is, or page 1, depending on who your sponsor is, or page 30, depending on what your sponsor says, through page 103. And page 103 is where the 12 steps are completed, right? That's all there is. But the next three chapters, Two Wives, Family Afterward, and Employer, I've been taught to look at as a continuation of chapter seven, which is working with others. Why? Because it's still talking to someone about the alcoholic, about how to work with the alcoholic. So I look at a lot of the suggestions and the principles can be applied in these next three chapters to the alcoholic prospect, or for me as a sponsor to tell me how to treat the prospect or the sponsor, the sick man, right? And how to help them without being overly helpful. And they have some, these chapters have some really, really good suggestions. I have gotten a lot of great sponsorship practices from these chapters. So those are pretty much going to be the highlights that I'm going to go over. I'm going to go ahead and start with paragraph three on page 104. Among us, our wives, relatives, and friends whose problem has been solved. There it is again, right? That's probably the eighth or ninth time it says that in the book, whose problem has been solved, as well as some who have not yet found a happy solution. We want the wives of alcoholics to address the wives of men who drink too much. Now, again, this is 12 years before the family group of Alan, the Al-Anon family groups were started, 12 years before. So this chapter was all the wives had at that time, or all the spouses had at that time, in what do we do with the drunks that we love, right? Because Al-Anon family groups was not there yet. And so that's why this chapter was written. What they say will apply nearly to everyone bound by ties of blood or affection to an alcoholic. And again, when I'm sponsoring something, when I'm sponsoring someone, I am that something is the affection that I have, is it applies. It really does. It applies. So as wives of alcoholics, or sponsors, or whatever you want to put in there, we would like you to feel that we understand, and perhaps, as perhaps few can. We want to analyze mistakes we've made. We want to leave you with the feeling that no situation is too difficult and no unhappiness too great to be overcome. Page 105, our men have sworn great solemn oaths that they were through drinking forever. We have believed them when no one else would or could. Then, in days, weeks, or months, a fresh outburst. This is just a reiteration of where in Bill's story, Bill says, you know, I've sworn it off forever. I've told Lois that I'm going to be done drinking forever. I think it's on page seven of Bill's story where he's like, but this time it's different. I meant business. And so I did. Like, I know I've said that I'm going to stop many, many times, and I've ended up drunk, but this time is different. And this is what it's talking about here. It's talking about, yeah, they're going to say that they're done forever, and they really believe it. You know, alcoholics really believe that. They're not in denial. They're not just denying it to you and knowing their head they're going to go get drunk. They're suffering alcoholic insanity. They believe it too. Like, they believe what they're telling you. And it doesn't make them bad. It makes them sick. And that's the point of that part there. And then on page 108, if you guys want to skip ahead a little bit, I really like this portion that talks about the four different types of drinkers. So number one, oh, you know what? Because of time, I think we'll start on the four different types of drinkers next week. I'll just finish with this part, I guess. On page 107, at the very bottom, it says, okay, and even if they did not love their families, how could they be so blind about themselves? What had become of their judgment, their common sense, their willpower? Why could they not see that drink meant ruin to them? Why was it when these dangers were pointed out? So this is talking to the wife, right? Or this talking to the non-alcoholic loved one. Why was it when these dangers were pointed out, they agreed? And then they got drunk again immediately. And the answer to this, and I have it in my notes on the side, is because froth don't work. Frothy emotional appeal seldom suffices. You can beg and plead and point out everything that they've done and everything that they've done wrong and all the times that they said one thing and did another, and you can become judgmental of them and you can threaten them, and froth don't work. If they could change, if they could quit drinking, they wouldn't need AA. If I could stop drinking, I wouldn't have needed AA. So I'll stop there, Brooke, and then we can go over the four types of husbands, four types of drinkers. Don't get it confused with four types of alcoholics, because one of those types are non-alcoholic next week.
All audio and video files on the District6AA.org website or the District 6 in Area 15 YouTube channel are for personal use only. Reproduction, distribution, and commercial use are not permitted. In accordance with District 6 current practice, no faces are shown in our videos and audio is scrubbed for anonymity prior to publishing. Contributors whose voices are heard have given record and release consent. Opinions expressed by the presenter are their own and do not necessarily represent the group conscience of District 6 as a whole.